Thank you for listening to the WOLA podcast. I'm Adam Isaacson. It is February 27th, 2019. I'm here with Jeff Ramsey, who works on our Venezuela program. It's kind of a coup to get, I shouldn't use the word coup, it's kind of a coup to get my hands on some of Jeff's time, because as you might imagine, things in Venezuela have been moving at an incredible pace. And we're going to talk about a lot that's been going on. But Jeff, first, thank you for making some time and hitting the microphone with me.
Yeah, no worries. It's been a really busy couple of weeks. I mean, I think everybody who works on Venezuela really hasn't had a weekend over the last month. It's been pretty insane.
Yeah, I guess you're mainlining coffee at this point through your veins. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot to talk about, and a lot of us who don't follow Venezuela as closely are either sort of mystified about what the Trump administration is up to, what the opposition's up to. Some folks I know who are talking about are worried that this could be the first major U.S. military intervention in Latin America since perhaps Panama in 1989. And one, certainly if you follow Marco Rubio's Twitter feed and others, that there is concern that we may be, the drumbeat for war is something like happening like we've never heard really in a long time. How alarmed should we be about military intervention?
Well, I think we should absolutely be alarmed. It is alarming to even discuss it.
Yes.
Because as you rightly pointed out in an excellent piece that I highly recommend listeners check out, intervention in Venezuela would be a complete nightmare. You know, one thing is the regular armed forces. Another is, you know, the presence of irregular armed groups, you know, everybody from the ELN to the FBL to armed government supporters known as colectivos, as well as the Bolivarian militias. I mean, there is a real chance of any kind of armed intervention turning into a protracted internal armed conflict that could last decades. But I think the good news is I don't actually think, I mean, it is on the table, and I am alarmed by that, but it's definitely not the basis of the U.S. or international strategy, and I'm encouraged by that fact.
Mm-hmm. That has not flipped at all, despite what happened last on February 23rd with the failed attempt to deliver aid. Certainly, the international community does not seem to be on board.
No, I mean, we saw the Lima Group reject this in their latest statements. You know, they have been very clear in rejecting the use of force, and I think it's really important that we've seen some more nuance on that issue from key U.S. allies in the region, primarily Colombia and Panama. So, if you remember last year, Almagro went to the border and said, you know, all options need to be on the table. We need to start talking about responsibility to protect.
Almagro, the Secretary General of the OAS.
Sure. Sorry, I should have specified. That was met pretty swiftly by a Lima Group statement that rejected that entire line of thinking. But there were notable absences. I mean, the Lima Group, you know, just because you're a Lima Group country doesn't mean you sign on to every Lima Group statement.
Right.
And neither Colombia nor Panama signed on to that statement. And we were all really concerned because we thought this was them potentially signaling that for them it could be on the table. But really important to note that in the last two Lima Group statements, Colombia and Panama have joined with the rest of the region. That includes Brazil under Bolsonaro and every other leader in the Lima Group in explicitly rejecting the use of force. So the Lima Group has really taken that off the table, at least in terms of regional support.
Mm-hmm.
I think the U.S. is still interested in keeping it on the table, but it's primarily for the sake of saber rattling. You know, there is this, I think, misguided thinking that if we saber rattle hard enough, you know, if we really threaten to invade, then that's going to just cause the Venezuelan armed forces to wither and abandon abandon Maduro, and that's going to force a transition. And I think that thinking is flawed.
I don't know where it's ever happened before.
Yeah, it's very bizarre.
A bluff can actually cause a military to collapse and turn against its leaders.
Yeah, especially because people who follow this stuff have actually pointed to an internal training manual within the Venezuelan armed forces that talks about it's essentially, it was Chavez's insurance policy. It was basically like, in the event of emergency, break glass and turn your regular armed forces into an irregular clandestine insurgency. This is very
so
much...
this is real, okay.
Yeah, so there is a plan, there is a contingency plan within the armed forces to deal with this. And so I don't think that threatening an invasion really in any way, shape, or form is a deterrent to people still sticking with Maduro. I think instead we're likely to... I should back up here. The strategy, very clearly, for the U.S. right now is about incentives. It's about incentivizing people that Maduro relies on, who control the levers of power, to break from him. And the way you manage their incentives is through sticks and carrots. The primary sticks so far have been sanctions against these individuals. Over 80 people now have had their visas revoked or denied, and they've had their U.S. visas frozen.
Mm-hmm. Assets
frozen, I should say. The interesting thing, though, is that if you look at the number of people who have been named by Treasury, only two people have actually flipped. Only two people that have been targeted by Treasury or sanctioned by Treasury in Venezuela have actually flipped. The interesting thing is that neither of them are actually eligible for any kind of sanctions relief because they're sanctioned under the Kingpin Act. It's a former military figure called Cliver Alcalá, who's currently living in Colombia, and the most recent defection, El Pollo Carvajal, both of whom are alleged to have been involved in drug trafficking.
And if it's under the Kingpin Act, I mean, there's a whole legal machinery that's under, you know, the Justice Department basically wants you, and yeah, you cannot reverse that.
Yeah.
Well, once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer by U.S. law. Whereas if you're corrupt, they can forgive you, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is not really flipping a lot of people, though, is pressure short of saber rattling going to work?
Well, I think that's why, you know, we've tried to be very clear on the Venezuela team that pressure is very important, and making pressure in the form of sanctions more effective can be accomplished by making sanctions more multilateral and by communicating more clearly to the targets of the sanctions how sanctions relief can occur.
Mm-hmm.
We just know that from looking at the literature. These are factors that make sanctions more effective. However,
so step one, step two, step three, this is what we need to hear from you, and these sanctions will go away.
Exactly, yeah. And we're starting to see that. I've been really encouraged that the last round of targeted sanctions that we saw against four governors in Venezuela were accompanied by language that is the clearest that it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Previous language was that the U.S. would consider lifting sanctions against individuals who take, I think it's like demonstrable and clear steps. I have to go back and look at the language, but it's who take certain steps to restore democracy or speak out against corruption or end or break from the Maduro regime. The new language is not "will consider," it's "sanctions relief is available to those who do X, Y, and Z," which is a really important distinction. We'll see if it makes any difference in terms of the effectiveness of these sanctions, but certainly that's a factor that makes them more effective.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, this is all, we're all talking about sticks here. The sanctions are a stick. The biggest stick of all is the oil sanctions.
Right. Which, let's talk about those for a moment, because they almost seem like they could cause more, I mean, knowing what we know, they could cause more of a humanitarian crisis than even an invasion could, if they actually drag on for a long time. Is that a correct impression, that you could actually end up with real, even more widespread hunger than Venezuela already has?
Absolutely. The state oil industry, the state-run oil industry, accounts for about anywhere from 65% to 80% of the hard currency that the state uses to pay for imports in Venezuela. And that's imports of everything. That's imports of food, medicine, medical equipment, everything. Of course, that's an important... The fact that that is state control has been an important control mechanism for the Maduro regime. Mm-hmm. It's been another added perk to the many perks that he's given the military over the right. years. But it's also been the sole, you know, the source of the state's ability to pay for much needed and increasingly scarce food and medicine. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear that the root of the current economic crisis in Venezuela lies in Maduro's own economic mismanagement and corruption.
Right.
However, with these new oil sanctions, we know that there will be a broader impact on the general public. And the fault, the blame for the current economic crisis can start to shift towards the United States the longer that these sanctions are in place.
Sort of the Cuban model where the instead of mismanagement, the Castros have always been able to blame poverty on the Americans. Fairly or not, that's always been this huge factor there. But I mean, but even beyond just the political implications, what are the humanitarian implications? If Venezuela cannot sell oil to anybody, and the boats are just sitting idly in the Caribbean, and eventually no one's even buying, and Venezuela has no foreign exchange with which to buy imports, A, is that what will happen? And B, I mean, how, you know, what would be the impact on just Venezuela's ability to survive if that's true?
Yeah. So, what I think is really interesting is that the regime has already taken steps to deal with this. I mean, they're starting to export a ton more oil to the Indians, for instance, to India, I should say.
And that is making it to India?
Yeah, yeah, they're starting to. So, you know, yes, the revenue from the oil sector is going to dramatically decrease. Mm-hmm. But it won't be eliminated altogether. Okay. And so I don't think that that's going to completely wipe out Maduro's ability to pay the people he needs to pay to stay in power. Mm-hmm. And it's also important to note that these people have other perks. You know, the military has their hands in everything from illicit food trafficking to allegedly drug trafficking.
There are other sources of foreign exchange that are not in the legal economy, right?
Absolutely. I mean, illicit mining is another mm-hmm. big one. So yeah, I'm not convinced that these oil sanctions are going to really eliminate Maduro's ability to pay the people he needs to pay. But I do know that they're going to have a broader impact. And I think what we're going to start to see first is widespread gasoline shortages, because of course, wow, Venezuela doesn't refine its own oil. They have to refine it because it's a very heavy crude. They have right. to send it to the U.S. and refine it there and get it back.
I didn't know that was their entire gasoline supply. Wow.
Yeah, there may be some the more limited, majority. But the vast majority, yeah. I mean, it depends on refineries in the Gulf.
Wow.
So we're going to start to see gas shortages in Venezuela. There are already reports that I have heard of people outside of the major cities, outside of Caracas, outside of other major cities, where they're starting to see this. It hasn't yet been confirmed in Caracas, at least not to us. And that's important because that, you know, that doesn't just mean that people have less gas in their cars or people aren't able to drive. It also means that that's less gas for transportation, for public transport,
right.
Transport of trucks, you know, the
cargo, people
exactly.
getting to work, you know, just mm-hmm. every economy needs transportation, yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, the sanctions, they also apply to the export of every U.S. export of every refined oil product to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So that's gasoline, but that's also diesel. And that's a big deal in a country that undergoes rolling blackouts because people rely on generators
right.
that rely on diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And those generators, you know, they run everything from people's homes, people's water purifiers, as well as, you know, community clinics, things like that. Emergency rooms rely on electric generators.
So you could see widespread misery. Do you see a connection between widespread misery and regime change?
Well, there's two lines of thinking on that. There are people who really do believe that over time, people are just going to stand up in Venezuela and that, you know, producing mass suffering is really going to lead to regime change.
This
and
is
that
the
time.
The Cuba theory, basically.
Well, exactly. And those same people have to account for why that didn't work in Cuba.
Right.
But I'm increasingly in the camp of time actually favors Maduro, because if he can weather this, we've talked to figures in the regime in Venezuela, and they've been very clear, this is their special period. They really do think that they can sit this out, that they can, this is going to be really tough for them over the next several years. But the longer that this goes on, and the more that especially the U.S. keeps saber-rattling, if U.S. intervention ever were to be more on the table than it is, that's the first thing that's going to break is the regional consensus,
right?
As it did in Cuba.
Right.
And you're going to start to see an increasing begrudging acceptance of an authoritarian regime in Venezuela. So that, I think, really is their bet. And I am increasingly in this camp of actually time favors Maduro, because once there's gas shortages, once there's harsher shortages of food and medicine, that is another incentive for the regime to buy the loyalty of who it needs to buy. If they may not be able to provide for their people, but they can certainly ensure that the people who they need to look out for are the ones getting food, medicine, gasoline, diesel, right, everything else.
And they won't feel the pain.
Yeah.
So, okay. Time favors Maduro. Sanctions are worth trying if they're multilateral and have a clear exit. But what do you say? I wrote something a few days ago, a warning against military intervention, and I have had innumerable people on social media say to me, no, all other options have been tried. Why would you even talk about dialogue, sanctions, military intervention? Yeah, military intervention now was the number one trending topic on Twitter on the night of the February 23rd. What do you say to those people about other options?
Well, so as I said, this is about carrots and sticks, but right, so far we've only been talking about sticks.
Right.
I think at some point you need to start thinking about carrots. I think, it's no coincidence that both the opposition in Venezuela and the United States, things that we've heard from Elliot Abrams, Mike Pence recently said this as well. Mm-hmm. The line is, the only thing that Maduro has to negotiate is the conditions of his exit, right? Well, that implies a negotiation. That implies, on some level, talking, if not to him, to the people around him, and trying to figure out exactly what they need to get on board a transition.
Yeah, conditions of exit implies some level of impunity, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah. And the opposition knows this. The National Assembly has at least laid on the table a potential amnesty law, though it has not actually been voted on nor finally passed the National Assembly.
Mm-hmm. And that's for more than just the armed forces. That would be for other regime members.
It's for the armed forces and for civilians. Mm-hmm. I should say this, the amnesty proposal is intentionally vague. It's really interesting. Two things about the amnesty law. It gives a great deal of flexibility to military and civilian judges. Mm-hmm. It basically says they can use the amnesty on a case-by-case basis. But it also says that any amnesty must be constitutional. The thing is, Article 29 of Venezuela's constitution specifically says there can be no amnesty for human rights violations or crimes against humanity. And the Venezuelan constitution recognizes economic and social rights. So if you are a governor, let's say, who has pocketed money instead of building infrastructure, that could be considered a human rights violation. Right. That is denying, that's money that could otherwise be going to building a clinic, increasing the public
medicine,
welfare.
Sure.
Exactly. So I think there needs to be more work done on making the amnesty proposal credible. It's going to be a very, very bitter pill to swallow, understandably, because this regime has done terrible things. But this is, we've seen transitional processes occur elsewhere in
Latin
America.
Right next door in Colombia.
And right next door, recently in right, Colombia. There was a very similar
This is what I work on. This is where you saw reduced prison sentences offered to those who did commit serious war crimes in exchange for full confessions and reparations. Maybe that would be palatable to the Venezuelan regime members if they're under enough pressure.
Yeah, and I think obviously, that needs to be figured out by the Venezuelans. That's not something that I think the U.S. can or should necessarily take a lead role on.
What about the larger international community?
I think what the international community should be doing is talking about this openly and talking about a political solution, which they have been doing, and I'm encouraged by that. But ultimately, the issue of transitional justice and any kind of amnesty is one that is going to have to be resolved by the Venezuelan opposition and by Venezuelan civil society to figure out what exactly is tolerable. I should say this, so the amnesty law is one potential carrot that has already been put on the table that is essentially stalled, but I expect we may see some resurgence of debate around that proposal over time. Another interesting proposal that we've heard from figures in the opposition in recent days is the idea of being more proactive in involving Chavismo as a political force and the military in any kind of transition. So basically, the line of the opposition right now is: this is what a transition looks like. It's three steps. It is ending the usurpation. It is a transitional government, and it's holding new elections.
Right.
Under the assumption that the legitimate leader of the transitional government is Juan Guaido, interim president. Right.
Right. So he'd be there for a few months if you actually got rid of the usurpation.
Exactly. But the way that they're doing that is essentially a transition that is not particularly flexible. I mean, the U.S. and the opposition are basically saying, like, look, this is what a transition looks like. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is unplug from Maduro and plug into Guaido. And I think what we've seen, or the lack of action that we've seen, the lack of really major key defections of anybody who, Maduro really relies on to maintain his hold on power, I think we can interpret their silence, particularly the silence of the high military command around the events of February 23rd, when the opposition was trying to get humanitarian aid into the country. It was really notable that the high military command in Venezuela didn't give the same kinds of public expressions of loyalty that they had in the past.
They weren't on Twitter. They weren't in the camera frame. Yeah.
Right. And I think that we can interpret that as a strategic silence. I think what they're saying is, look,
super interesting.
Give us a better offer. And it makes sense. You're asking a lot of them. You're asking them to topple Maduro and to blindly just plug into Guaido. What kinds of assurances are they going to get? Why would they do that? Why? How are their interests going to be reflected in a transition? It's extremely messy and it is very unsavory, but I think the best explanation for why we've seen inaction on their part. And so one offer is the amnesty offer, right? But that, even beyond the amnesty, I think we need to think about other ways to onboard the military as well as Chavismo as a political force. You could think about, for instance...
Yeah, they still represent some, small maybe, but some percentage of the population.
Yeah, I mean, there's between 15% and 20% of the Venezuelan population that still has a favorable opinion of Maduro, which is insane in a country that is under, in the midst of a humanitarian crisis.
Right.
And so I think, we've seen some interesting proposals on this line, most notably the second vice president of the National Assembly, Stalin Gonzalez, has talked about, has hinted that the opposition might be willing to give formal roles to the military and to Chavismo in a transitional government. So that's talking more about power sharing. That's, giving these people posts in a transitional government.
This is for the transitional government, be posts in that government that is there for the few months until elections, is what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's other things that have been done in the past that I think warrant further study. Before a transition could occur in Chile, for instance, the military ensured that it got a certain percentage of the state copper industry to go directly to its budget.
The permanent Senate seats. Semi-permanent Senate seats.
It's I mean, these are all horrible things, but these were, ultimately the forces of democracy in Chile.
FARC has 5 senators and 5 congressmen for the next 8 years. I mean, in Colombia, I mean, things like this do happen.
Yeah. I mean, these are the bitter pills that you have to swallow when you think about a transition. I am encouraged that the opposition is increasingly talking about this. And I think there are ways that the U.S. and others in the international community can encourage them to be more proactive. Yes, yeah. It's going to be met with severe backlash from the opposition base. But I think we also have to remember that there are going to be spoilers in every camp. I mean, there are people in Chavismo who really do think that it's worth having a military intervention. I mean, there are people in Chavismo that are willing to head to the hills for Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
So there are going to be people on every side who I think are going to want to see this as a winner-take-all framework. And I think, you know, we just need to move past that.
They have to be marginalized, basically.
Exactly.
To do this.
Yeah.
Now, just in what form is this going to happen? I mean, I was going to ask about what international efforts underway or proposed to be underway or even worth looking at, but you keep making the point about that the opposition itself needs to be more proactive and this has to be a Venezuelan solution. So is there some forum, some space where the opposition and or at least pragmatic members of the opposition can get together and start putting this stuff down on a whiteboard and working it out? Or do you need the internationals to make that even that space possible?
Yeah, well, I think the U.S. insists that everybody who needs to talk is talking, and that, you know, there is communication between both sides. We've heard that that is somewhat true, but I think that there are ways to systematize this.
I guess my question is, does the opposition first need to have talks with itself about how optimistic to be? Or are they pretty, is there reasonable consensus now on offering carrots?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that the opposition, so the stereotype of the Venezuelan opposition is that they're bitterly divided, they're disorganized. Mm-hmm. I think they've proven that entirely wrong over the last 2 months by getting behind a single leader, really strengthening this leadership structure. I mean, they have an interim president. This is their guy. I think that's been really helpful because that really cuts down on the ability of spoilers to get things done or for people
right.
to basically splinter off. And so I think that rather, I'm encouraged by the level of organization within the opposition. I don't think that...
So they are prepared to negotiate.
I think that
they together. Okay.
More than ever before, they have a structure where they could actually negotiate in an organized, incredible fashion. I think the question is, who do you negotiate with? And that is one that if you talk to the opposition, what they say is, we're willing to negotiate with the military, we're willing to negotiate with Chavismo, we're not willing to negotiate with Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Maduro needs to leave, and then we'll negotiate with whoever forces him out.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, what do you do? Well,
that's interesting.
There's two problems. First, what are you going to, you know, we get back to the idea of carrots. What are you going to give these people to make them take this risky step of forcing them a little while?
Are these basically the same you mentioned early on in this conversation about the sanctions, people who hold the levers of power who are not quite Maduro, who have been targeted by the sanctions, sort of the same cohort of people?
Yeah, and they're an unsavory bunch. I mean, it is people like Diosdado Cabello, Delcy Rodriguez, Jorge Rodriguez. I mean, these are people in Maduro, like Vladimir Padrino López, the defense minister. I mean, these are people who are not good guys.
Right.
But they are key stakeholders of Maduro.
Right.
So the question is, you know, what can you give them? And what assurances can you give them to make them take this very risky step, right? That's one question. Another question is, what do you do if they never do? What do you do if you want to negotiate with everybody else but Maduro, and everybody else but Maduro is telling you, this is our guy, then at some point you're going to have to talk to Maduro.
Right.
The strategy right now is produce the break within the regime, negotiate with everybody else around Maduro once Maduro's gone. I think that is a very... That's a strategy that I think very logically leads to a transition. I am concerned that that may not be possible. I'm concerned that these key stakeholders, the military, Chavismo, are saying, we're with Maduro, negotiate with Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
That would really weaken the opposition's hand and would limit what exactly could be negotiated.
Right.
So there's very strong reasons for the opposition to not want to do that. But with time, I think we may see some interest in that. But as I said, I don't think that's the primary...
It's not their first choice.
It's not the first choice. Yeah. First choice mm-hmm. is to negotiate with everybody else but Maduro. Mm-hmm.
And that, if it's like sort of a multi-dyad negotiation with many different people, this is not happening in some big room somewhere. This is a very informal, quiet process. It's not something that would have internationals, say, being like providing the room. It's much more...
Well, assuming
it's happening over WhatsApp, if it's happening.
Assuming it's happening, it's happening very quietly.
Yeah.
I think there are reasons to ensure that it is happening, though. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is conjecture. A lot of this is Elliot Abrams, you know, saying that everybody who needs to talk is talking.
Uh-huh.
But we don't really know that. I mean, what I know is that, you know, sanctioned figures in the regime have had their family, who is abroad, be approached by folks in state and treasury and elsewhere. I mean, there are ways that the U.S. government is trying to reach out in some kind of, you know, game of telephone to these figures. I'm sure the intelligence community is doing its thing and trying mm-hmm. to communicate mm-hmm. as effectively as possible with these people directly. But there way be there. But again, we don't know that. And my concern is that people are exaggerating the extent to which communication is occurring around this. So it may be helpful to have a political process, some kind of channel for this kind of communication to occur, some kind of intermediary group. Mm-hmm. And that is the International Contact Group.
Tell me about the International Contact Group, which I know you have talked a lot and written a lot about, but we haven't mentioned them yet in this podcast.
Yeah, so the International Contact Group, it is a group of, I believe it's... I have to check the number of countries in the European Union, but it's a number of European countries.
I think it was eight.
Eight European countries, as well as a representative of the European Union, mm-hmm. and representatives of three Latin American countries. Those are Uruguay, Ecuador, and Costa Rica. Costa Rica is really interesting because they're a Lima Group country as well.
Right, right.
And all three countries have kind of... They've expressed sort of a very interesting kind of not neutrality, but this desire to be useful in some kind of political transition.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that that's the International Contact Group is very different from empty. From talk about empty dialogue without preconditions.
We've seen like dialogues like in the Dominican Republic that appeared to do nothing but buy time for Maduro in the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is not that.
No, the opposition went to dialogue in 2014 directly with Maduro, mm-hmm. and it was a complete failure. The opposition engaged in dialogue in late 2016 and early 2017 with the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
regime completely failed to do what it said it was going to do. Then they went again to the Dominican Republic in a process that actually had guarantor countries. And once again, the regime didn't negotiate in good faith.
Right.
And the whole process fell apart. So the mandate of the contact group is not to have negotiations. It is not a mediation group.
Mm-hmm.
It is not about dialogue. It is explicitly about creating the conditions for new, free, and fair elections mm-hmm. to occur in Venezuela.
So if you don't want to talk about that, don't even bother coming.
Exactly.
Okay.
We saw some initial movement from the Mexicans, and as well, you know, they did have some echo from the Uruguayans at first about no, dialogue without preconditions. Let's have a Montevideo mechanism. If you remember, the
right after
Mexican,
January 23rd, this happened. Yeah,
yeah. Right on the eve of the first meeting of this International Contact Group, the Mexican foreign minister came down to Montevideo and met with his Uruguayan counterpart, and a couple of Caribbean diplomats were there, and they talked about, you know, we're going to have a Montevideo mechanism. It's going to be basically just dialogue with no preconditions.
Here we go again, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Then the next day, the European Union contact group representatives showed up, and were very clear, like, guys, that's not us. Like, we're not going to get on board that. You need to choose whether you're going to participate in this group, which is about elections, or something else. And we don't think that other thing would be very productive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of a Montevideo mechanism has fallen to the wayside. The Uruguayans are now firmly in the camp of new elections and not dialogue without preconditions. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, because a lot of people sort of, they hear about this contact group and they think, well, we've tried it before, it's not going to work. What they don't get is that this has new elections baked into it. It's not about dialogue for the sake of dialogue. And it's also, I think, what makes it different from previous attempts at having a negotiated solution is that internal and external pressure in Venezuela are higher than ever.
Right, right.
And so I think that the incentives for the regime, or at least, again, people around Maduro, to negotiate in good faith are higher than they've ever been.
So where is the contact group now as a process? I mean, what are its contemplated next steps?
So the contact group actually carried out a technical visit to Caracas last week, I should say.
Huh.
It was a small technical team. It was co-chaired by an EU representative and an Uruguayan representative. They met with stakeholders in Venezuela, including members of the opposition, as well as with the regime. But they've been very quiet about what came out of those meetings. I think for good reason. I think nobody wants to give oxygen to the regime.
Want to do this in the press either.
Yeah, you don't want to give Maduro a reason to say, look, I'm playing nice, right, and these people are still, you know, nobody wants to let up pressure. They want to get something done. And so we haven't heard a lot about what has come out of those meetings, but I am encouraged that they're happening. I'm encouraged that this is a model that's being explored, because it's worked out well in the past. If you remember, the Contadora group...
opposed by Elliot Abrams in the 1980s, yeah.
Exactly.
That was an effort with Colombia, Panama, Mexico, and one other country to try to bring an end to the Central American Civil Wars in the mid-80s.
Yeah. And this was a similar sort of contact group.
I think Venezuela was the other country.
Oh, sorry, it was Venezuela. Venezuela was the other country. Yeah, there's sort of some historical irony there. Yeah. It is this model of a contact group basically carrying out shuttle diplomacy, talking to all sides and trying to figure out, you know, hammer out the conditions needed to move forward and put an end to the civil wars in Central America. And that's a model that I think is at least worth exploring in Venezuela.
And, you know, one reason the Contadora group did not succeed was because of either hostility or certainly lack of support from the Reagan administration. The U.S. is a factor here. What is the U.S. posture toward this effort? Is there a U.S. posture toward this effort?
They are at best indifferent and uninformed, and at worst hostile to the idea. Conversations that we've heard at State range from those two extremes. One, you know, either
the what group or exactly, you know, this is terrible.
Yeah. Exactly. No, this is, you know, you're giving oxygen to the regime,
right,
or it's not going to go anywhere. In both cases, though, I should say that people that we've been talking to around Washington don't actually understand the contact group. They have not looked at the terms of reference. They have not looked at the kinds of preconditions that the contact group is talking about that would be necessary to have credible elections in Venezuela. And that's things like restoring the integrity of the electoral structure in Venezuela,
right,
establishing a new electoral committee. It would mean an end to political prisoners, freeing political prisoners. It would also mean an end to restrictions that prevent opposition leaders from participating politically in the country.
Right.
So it's not like people are just willy-nilly saying, you know, let's just have new elections. These are, you know, the entire process is aimed at having new elections that are free, fair, and credible. The big question is whether that can happen with Maduro still in power.
Right.
I think, again, this goes back to, can you really pick and choose who you negotiate with? So far, the key stakeholders of Maduro are with Maduro, but that may change. But what that looks like, if that changes, Padrino López, the defense minister of Venezuela, may rise up, depose Maduro, ship him off to Cuba, and say, you know, and then talk about negotiating with the opposition to hand over the keys. Or that kind of pressure may be more quiet. It may be behind the scenes. It may come in the form of, like, look, there's got to be new elections. Mm-hmm. You've got to name a new electoral committee. You've got to do all these things that the contact group is talking about. We need new elections. Mm-hmm. The way out of this is for credible elections to occur. What I'm saying is there may be a way for those around Maduro to abandon Maduro without actually forcing him out of the country or out of office beforehand. That's not what the opposition wants, but that may be more palatable to the military and to Chavismo as a political force.
But even that, I mean, now I'm starting to abuse your time and we'll wrap up soon, but even that, I mean, there are reasons why nobody wants to be the first person in the inner circle to be the one who proposes that.
Yeah.
So that would even that would have to be coordinated and sort of pre-cooked somewhat.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, I think it's really important.
If you're the first one, I mean, you're in exile at best if no one else goes along with you.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, that's why there is such a, you know, this is a risky move. There are very natural barriers to being the first one to act.
Right.
It's a collective action problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I think it's really important that the U.S. and the opposition, primarily the opposition, really, is reaching out to these people and figuring out what they want. What do they need to get on board a transition? What can you give them? What can you, you know, what kinds of things are palatable in order to bring them on board? Again, they claim they're already doing this. People claim that they're talking.
Mm-hmm.
I will believe it when I see it, and that's why I think that this idea of some kind of contact group to ensure that that communication is happening is a good idea.
Right. And is Eric Guaido and the opposition at least open to it?
Yeah, it's been interesting. We were expecting Guaido and the opposition, or rather, I should say the National Assembly,
mm-hmm.
To reject the idea entirely. But they actually issued a statement that didn't reject the idea. Well, they did reject the idea of dialogue with no preconditions, so mm-hmm. they poo-pooed the Montevideo mechanism, and rightly so, because that would have been a disaster. But they did open a door to this contact group. They requested the EU to specify its mandate, to basically say, okay, well, I guess we're with you, but we need to make sure that what you're talking about is this three-step process, end of the usurpation, transitional government, mm-hmm. and elections. Basically, they want to ensure that what the European Union is talking about in this contact group is getting Maduro out first and then having elections.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen that clarification, but the opposition still hasn't backed away. So there's still some intentional ambiguity around all of this.
So that's where we are now.
Yeah.
Well, also where we are now, as we talk on February 27th, Juan Guaido is going to somehow end up back in Venezuela, it appears.
Yeah.
If that does not go smoothly, will that affect the calculations for the contact group and all other efforts to resolve?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are very strong reasons why Maduro would not want to touch Guaido. I mean, it's
right.
The whole reason why he hasn't been arrested in the first place. It's because
yeah.
I think Maduro understands that any kind of good faith he has now, any kind of, you know, iota of good faith that he has, would just completely get washed away
mm-hmm.
if anything were to happen to Guaido. So I think that if Guaido, I mean, he's claiming that he's going to just fly in to Maiquetía, you know, the main Caracas airport,
yeah.
and just walk back in. It's hard for me to imagine, however, that Maduro is going to want to let that happen with no repercussions. So what I think is going to happen is there's going to be a real strong incentive for Maduro to do something,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, probably not arresting him and putting him under house arrest like they did in
Leopoldo. Give him the Jorge Ramos treatment, maybe? Maybe. Something
and,
temporary.
And we know that already happened once, right?
Right,
he was
right.
temporarily detained by Sabine, by intelligence mm-hmm. Officials. So that may be a way of Maduro to save face and say, look, I had the opportunity to do something to this guy, but I didn't, but I'm still in charge.
Mm-hmm.
We may see that. But I am worried that, you know, we may see something more aggressive, and that would very, very much escalate the crisis, and we're going to be watching that in the coming days.
Yeah, unless you're listening to this podcast in the coming days, you already know how this has turned out.
Yeah.
We have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your time, Jeff. I think it was really important that we got out the message that there are still other options, that there are, short of a military confrontation, that most folks are not on board with that, that the dialogue with these very strict baked-in conditions that you mentioned still makes sense, and that there are serious people working on it. And
that you can do it without, that you know, engagement does not mean you need to let up the pressure. These right. things are not mutually exclusive.
That's why they say carrots, sticks and carrots.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Thank you so much for your time, Jeff. And boy, I think I'm going to have to listen to this over a few times, and maybe you might have to also, because we covered a lot of ground very quickly. So feel free to move your to move your podcast player back to the beginning and replay this, because we did cover quite a bit. Appreciate the clear explanations, Jeff, and good luck over the next few weeks.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to the Wallet Podcast. Please tune in again soon.